The Book of Daniel. The story set right after Babylon's first attack on Jerusalem, and they had plundered the city and its temple and taken a wave of Israelites into exile. Let's just dive in. Chapter 1 introduces the basic tension of the first half of the book. Daniel and his friends, they're really wise and capable, and they're recruited to serve in the royal palace of Babylon. But they're pressured to give up their Jewish identity by living and eating like Babylonians and violating the Jewish food laws found in the Torah. So they refuse, and they choose faithfulness to the Torah, and it puts them in danger. But God delivers them, and they end up being elevated by the king of Babylon. After this begins the Aramaic section, which you'll see has this really cool symmetrical design. So first, the king of Babylon has a dream that, it turns out, only Daniel is able to interpret. It's about a huge statue made of four types of metal, and it symbolizes a sequence of kingdoms, and the head is Babylon. But then a huge rock comes flying in, and it shatters the statue, and it becomes this huge mountain. Now, this dream is the first of many symbolic visions in the book, and this one introduces the basic storyline of them all. Daniel says that the statue represents a train of human kingdoms following from Babylon, and they will all fill God's world with violence. But one day, God's kingdom will come and will confront and humble the arrogant kingdoms of this world and fill the world with the healing justice of God's reign and rule. After this, chapter 3 tells the famous story of Daniel's three friends who refuse to bow down and worship a huge idol statue, which, like the statue in chapter 2, represents the king and his imperial power. And so the friends are persecuted, they're thrown into a fiery furnace, but God delivers them from death, and they're exalted by the king who now acknowledges their God as the true one. After this come a pair of stories about two Babylonian kings, the father, Nebuchadnezzar, and then his son, Belshazzar. They're both filled with pride because of their imperial power, and so, like in chapter 2, God warns them both through dreams and then visions, which, also like chapter 2, only Daniel can interpret. He says that both kings are to humble themselves before God, and both kings arrogantly resist. So Nebuchadnezzar is stricken with madness. He becomes like a beast in the field. But then he humbles himself before God, and his humanity returns to him. He's restored as king. This is in contrast with his son, Belshazzar, who doesn't humble himself before God, and he's assassinated that very night.
So that brings us to where we're at in Daniel. We're here in Daniel chapter 5. I want to invite you to turn there. We will be reading from chapter 5 today. It brings us into this new section with a new king that we'll get to in a moment. And what we will find is that the people in the book of Daniel, especially at this point, are looking for answers. They're looking for hope. There's this question of, what is it that you will hold on to? This is my first time back in a month. I was gone for 3 weeks. I got some nice messages from some of you because I went out west. I told some of you before we left in one of the sermons that I was driving to Oregon with my family. It worked. We made it. We were all happy. We had a good time. Everyone got along well. It was a wonderful trip, and so I thank you for praying about that. There's many, many things that I could tell you about the trip, but I thought I would just show you one thing that maybe some of you have seen. This happened on our vacation, it happened at the Iowa State Fair, and it happened to my
just reboot it there. Here we go. Let's go with Camille. Come on, Camille, hang on.
That is called mutton busting. I don't know if any of you have ever participated in mutton busting. Some people asked me afterwards, does she do this often? And I thought, who does it often? Nobody does this often. What are you talking about? That's my youngest. Friends of ours had been to the fair the day before, and they said, you need to sign Camille up. They know Camille. If you know Camille, you know that that's right up her alley. She won. She was first place. She has a medal. She'll tell you about it. They invited her back at the end of the week for like the championships, but we were in Oregon, so we couldn't make it, of course. She held on. You know, when we're watching that, other kids did the same thing. Some of them couldn't hold on. Just couldn't hold on. Like right away they let go, it was done. Some of them would not hold on. They just couldn't. They wouldn't put their arms, they wouldn't put their legs around the sheep. They didn't want to grab on hard, so they wouldn't hold on. They fell off. And so frankly, I'll sound like a bragging parent. My daughter was the best. She held on with everything. We told her, hold on. She said, okay. She held on with her hands. She held on with her legs. And I don't think she fell off. I think she let go. I think she could have ridden that thing probably all the way to Oregon if she wanted to. You know, sometimes in our lives, I think we feel like we're just holding on. Some of us feel like we have a pretty good grip as to what's going on around us, what we're dealing with. Others of us, not so much. Others of us, we feel like we're just white-knuckling it wherever we're at this time. Chapter 4 ends, in the book of Daniel, it ends with Nebuchadnezzar declaring that God's ways are right and they're just and that God humbles those who are prideful. These are good truths. These are important truths. This is truth that you can hold on to, that God's good, that God's great, that God's ways are right, that he will humble those who are prideful. But these are also truths that are easily forgotten. And when we come to Daniel 5, 30 years have passed. 30 years have passed from the end of Daniel 4 to now Daniel 5. Daniel at this point is most likely about 80 years old. When we began this book, he's a teenager. Now he's an older man. To this point, it's only been Nebuchadnezzar. It's only been one king. And now we're going to see that things change, but in lots of ways, things also stay the same. And this question of what you're going to hold on to comes right to the forefront. So I want to invite you to stand if you're able as we read Daniel chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, and that the kings and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the kings and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the kings and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Father, may you add a blessing to the reading of your word. May my words be clear this morning. May we be attentive to your spirit, and may you be glorified. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So at this point, Nebuchadnezzar, the one king that we've been dealing with, is gone. He's passed on. And now we read that Belshazzar is king. As just an aside here, it's most likely that Belshazzar is his grandson, even though in our video it said he was his son. And as we read in here, it uses the word father to describe their relationship. Another translation of that word could be predecessor. And based on other historical documents that we have, we believe that Belshazzar is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. So when they talk about father and he talks about his father, it's in the same way that we would talk about an ancestral father or someone who precedes us. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had built a powerful kingdom, but when we come to chapter 5, it opens and we see that there's a new king. And so if we've been following along, if we were listening when we were in chapter 2, we know that after the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, there will be another kingdom that will come after him. And so we know now that there's a change in kings, that something is on the horizon. We know that something is coming. All right, we know that there's something ahead. The dream from chapter 2 tells us that when Nebuchadnezzar passes, another kingdom is going to happen. So these people and the book, and it's almost as though Daniel is saying, hold on, because trouble's on the horizon. Something's going to happen. We know this from the foreshadowing of chapter 2, but we know this historically as well. You know, most scholars believe that at this point, the Babylonians are surrounded by their enemies. There's a historical or an archaeological find called the Nabonidus Chronicle that corresponds historically with the book of Daniel. And it tells us that around this time, the Babylonians had suffered a crushing defeat at the hand of the Persians. They're surrounded by their enemies and they've hunkered down. And so Belshazzar is there in the city of Babylon. He has the people who are most important to him around him. And they are hunkered down in one last effort to defend the city. And so as this feast is going on, they can look out the window. They can probably see their enemies camped around them. Maybe they see and smell the smoke coming from the fire. Maybe they're still grieving over the defeats that they've had. They know that trouble is coming. I think that there's a lot of us here today that when we think about tomorrow and we think about next week, we think about next month and next year, we sense and have this idea that trouble is growing. And what do we do? What do we do when we sense that trouble is growing? Now, you've probably never quite been in a situation like this, I would imagine. I don't imagine that you've ever been encircled by real physical enemies that have camped out where you're at. But trouble does come our way. Trouble will come our way, and trouble may be coming your way right now. It might be physical trouble. It may be that at this point you feel as though your body is beginning to break down. I turned 43 weeks ago. It's not that big of a deal, okay? But the week after that, I decided to skateboard with my niece in Portland, Oregon. I never knew how to skateboard to begin with, okay? But I decided I was going to do that. And I jumped onto this skateboard very nicely. And then that skateboard took off that way, and I went this way. And I came down hard on my arm, and I thought, oh my, I've broken my arm. This is the biggest idiot move I've ever made. Been 40 for 5 days, and I've broken my arm. This is what I'm thinking. Luckily, it moves well. It's fine. But there are times where you might feel like, oh my goodness, right? There's trouble. This doesn't feel right. This isn't working well. You're waiting for a test to come back. Trouble. Maybe it is relational trouble. The things that you just sense, it's not clicking like it once did at home. The relationship that you have with a spouse or with a child has changed, right? You had a younger child who adored you. They're moving up. They're wondering if you're sane at this point. You're wondering if they're sane. There's changes. There's this sense of trouble. Maybe it's at work. Maybe you can see the writing on the wall, if you will, that this job isn't for you for much longer, that this company won't be around. There's trouble. Maybe it's trouble in the lives around us, it's people that we love. And we've all been in situations where we see, sense, and know that trouble is coming. But what do we do? What is it that you hold on to? This book is all about really the two directions that we go. We either go up or we go down. We either look to heaven or we look to earth. We either go to God or we go to ourselves. We either adopt some sort of pop psychology, pick your boots up, you can do it, think good thoughts, or we go to the God of creation. We go one of two ways. And I believe and I assert, and the book asserts, there's only one thing that you can hold on to that's going to get you through. And Belshazzar comes to this point, it seems, and he chooses to look at himself. He chooses to hold on to his own power, his own abilities, and in so doing, he provides what really is just a hopeless solution. And what would you do if there were millions, or not millions, but thousands of people camped outside of your city? If you were the king, what would you do? I'm sure some of you would start to reinforce areas. Maybe you would try an escape plan. He decides to throw a party. Feels like Pan Am. It's easy to second guess this one, but there's likely a method to his madness here. It seems like there's an attempt to calm his people down by demonstrating his power. It's this last ditch effort, if you will, to show confidence, to encourage the people, to calm them by a demonstration of power. And we read about it. In verses 2 through 4, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought. And then it tells us in verse 4 that they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. In these four verses, verses 2 through 4, the act of drinking, and the act of drinking wine specifically, is mentioned five times. So what Daniel is describing is not some sort of social gathering of social elite with wine and cheese and conversation. What he's describing is something that likely degraded into some kind of drunken orgy, some sort of all-out event. And in verse 3, we see that the Babylonians bring out these vessels that they've taken from the temple and vessels that they've probably taken from other temples of other communities and countries that they have defeated. Now, the early reader, the original reader to this would know that this is not something that you do. They would know that this is blasphemy. There's no decency here. Even with the holy things of another religion, it was sacrilege of the highest. And so why would he do this? It may be and probably was a result of the increased amount of alcohol that he decided to have this night. But also, this is this kind of last-ditch effort, all right, of Belshazzar and his contingent to remind the people of the superiority that they once held. You know, maybe, just maybe, we can awaken our gods. Maybe the thing that got us here is the thing that will help us to continue. It's almost like a pep rally. Remember, we conquered all of these other kingdoms. See the things that we have from their temples. This reminds us of our once great might, and we will do this again. It's kind of this last-ditch solution. But the solution that he offers and this kind of encouragement leaves nothing to really hold on to. It's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, hoping that it's going to lead to something different. The people hear the enemy. They see the enemy. They know what's on the horizon. And the solution offered here ignores the God of creation. It ignores the one true God. And the reader senses that this kind of behavior is not going to result in good things, because we saw just one chapter ago, one page back, what happens to a king who thinks he doesn't need God? He becomes humbled. And so here at this point, why would we assume as readers that it's going to be any different for Belshazzar? And that's what Daniel wants us to look and see. Why would we assume that his fate would be any better? And he's driving home the truth that when our solutions ignore God, they lead to greater trouble. When our solutions ignore him, it leads to greater trouble. When we choose to hold on to something other than God, other than his truth, other than the gospel, the good news of who Jesus is and what Jesus has done and why it matters, when we're going to hold on to anything other than that to get us through difficult times, we will find that it won't make it. Maybe if I just do more, maybe if I stay up later or get up earlier, maybe if I get to the next level, maybe if I make it to a new school, maybe if I do this, I, me, maybe I can do it. And we look to ourselves or we look to others. And how many times are we going to buy into the lie and allow ourselves to be seduced by the promise that someone else can make your problems go away? That a relationship will make things better. That if we just get the right people in office, the world will turn around. That if we just get the right judges where they need to be, everything's going to be better. I'm not saying don't be politically involved, but don't be politically hopeful. Don't let your hope sit there. Other times we bow to the gods of sex, of acceptance, of affirmation, of career, of relationship, and of family, and we keep thinking that if we just sacrifice enough to these things, if we just worship these things enough, if we just build our lives around these ideas, they will bring us deliverance. In the community that our church finds itself, it's an affluent community. Some of you might not feel like that every day, but it is. It's an affluent community, and there are people here who believe, and maybe even in this church, I can solve anything with a check. My kids are getting older. I've seen some of this. Someone's not on a team, then they are on a team because someone wrote a check. We just saw poor Aunt Becky from Full House, you know, tried to send her kids and buy them into college because we can solve anything with money. We can solve anything with a check. And what are we going to hold on to when a check won't solve it? Rich people die too. It comes for everyone. Judgment comes for everyone. A check isn't going to cut it at some point. What are you going to hold on to? And there are times, and in these times, we find that God's truth is solid, that it's something that we can hold on to. It's something that will be there. And when we ignore God and we try and build our solutions on anything other than his truth, we find our footing lacking. And these things lead to greater trouble. Look what it leads to for Belshazzar. It says, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. As they're praising their own gods, as they're mocking the God of creation, things go south quickly because there's a heavenly response. Now, some people believe that the only person who can see the handwriting is the king. And if you read it, you can read it that way. And that might be the case. It adds a layer of kind of craziness almost to this scene. The king losing his mind, watching this hand write. When Daniel comes in, Daniel can see it too. Either way, you get the idea that a hand just writing on a wall is not something that happens all the time. This isn't the Addams Family or something like that. The response happens immediately. And so it seems to happen also in a place where it's easily visible for the king. It's on a plaster wall. Most palace walls at that time were white. And then it happens across from or opposite the lampstand so that they can see it. God responds. And when God responds, he terrifies Belshazzar in the process. He terrifies him. When he sees this, he turns white as a ghost. His thoughts are frightening to him. He might have a tinge of understanding here. I've done something. I've angered someone. Something here isn't good. We're told his hip joints, his upper legs go limp. He's basically in shock, some sort of extreme panic. And his terror becomes apparent when we keep reading in verse 7. It says, the king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans and the astrologers. That is a very nice way of saying the king screamed his head off out of insanity for these people to come. Called loudly. If you're a parent, you've heard a kid yell for you, and then you've heard a kid yell for you. You've heard a kid yell for you, and then you get in the room, and they say, I can't find the remote. And then you find the remote, and you throw it out the window. And then you've heard a kid yell for you, and you know, and you sense in your heart, I need to be there now. Someone's hurt. Something's wrong. This is one of those kind of screams. We know that because who comes running? His mom. The queen comes running. This is likely his mother, Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. He's screaming. He's losing his mind. We have a bit of a repeat from chapter 2, right? Nebuchadnezzar brought in the wise men and said, I want to know this dream. He threatens them. I'm going to tear you limb from limb if you don't tell me the dream. Belshazzar going the other way. He went stick. He's going carrot. I will give you up to all of this in the kingdom. You'll be number 3. He realizes just how helpless he is. He becomes even more pale. They can't figure it out. Because here's the point. God's presence brings terror to those who ignore him. It brings terror to those who ignore him. A lot of times when we speak of God's presence, when we sing of God's presence, we do so with a hopeful tone, a happy tone, and a peaceful tone. And the reason that we do that is because we're singing about building our life around Jesus with this understanding and hope that that is who we have confidence in. And when we have Christ, we need not fear. We can come before the throne of grace with confidence because we wear Christ's righteousness, because Christ has gone in between us and God. He has made it right so that we can have a right relationship with him. But Belshazzar has no one standing between him and God. Belshazzar has no one there on his behalf. Belshazzar knows that he is mocked and ignored and blasphemed God. And he senses that judgment is there. When God declares his presence to those who ignore him and those who blaspheme him, it brings terror. When you go to Acts 9, Paul is struck blind, and then he hears the voice of Jesus. And when we read Paul's reaction and interaction, it isn't one of, oh, this is nice. It's one of terror. Because this is the person he's been mocking. This is the person he's been persecuting, trying to kill people who follow. And so he is scared and has a right to be. If we've ignored Jesus Christ, please understand this. We stand in judgment. The Bible says if we have set Jesus aside, if we are not making him the center of our life, then when God sees us, he sees the sin, the rebellion in our heart. That is what he sees. And so we stand like Belshazzar, having ignored Christ, trying to hold on to something, trying to keep it together. And God's presence, the mention of God, the truth of God, is something that brings us an unease, a spiritual uneasiness. Now, if you follow after Christ, if you make Christ the center of your life, then you stand justified. You stand just as if the sin in your life never happened. Because God looks at you and doesn't see the sin and rebellion in your heart. He sees Jesus Christ. So rather than seeing our sin, he sees his righteousness. And so in this context, God's presence doesn't remind us of a coming judgment. It reminds us of our current salvation. But when we ignore God, when we say things like, it's not for me, or I'll believe in something else, or you know what, I'll come back later to these kinds of things, then God's presence can bring terror. And as we get to this point, Daniel now is going to enter the scene. As Belshazzar is in terror, we have a mention of Daniel. The kingdom is in disarray, and once again, he's called upon. He has been God's chosen mouthpiece during his time in Babylon. He's delivered God's truth to Nebuchadnezzar, but he seems at this point to have disappeared, maybe to have been put on a shelf. We don't know the circumstances that surround his disappearance or why Belshazzar just really doesn't know what's going on or who he is. He may have been exiled with the other counselors that were counseling Nebuchadnezzar. He may have been set aside for a younger voice, for someone who's hipper. It may be that the king just didn't like what he had to say, so they put him aside. In a sense, it's as though Daniel had been forgotten and had been put aside, but the queen remembers. It's likely Belshazzar's mother, the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, so she would have known of Daniel. She would have known at least the stories. She knows that he has the wisdom of the gods and insight, intelligence, wisdom, an extraordinary spirit. She knows that Daniel has a connection. She knows that Daniel can figure out what's going on. So she says, bring him here. This is who you need. You know, it's not uncommon for people to set aside scripture and spiritual things because they're old-fashioned, they're narrow-minded, and we don't need them anymore. To put it on a shelf, that was for me when I was a kid. I'm older now, I'm more intelligent, I know that those things don't exist, that that's not real, I don't need that. We look for answers elsewhere, but we don't allow ourselves to look for God. But listen to me and understand this. Many of you know this. God's truth is truth, even when it's old. Is this old-fashioned? I think you could say that to a point. The Bible is old-fashioned. But some things that are old-fashioned are timeless. God's truth is truth, even when it's old. I'm a big Detroit Tigers fan. They've had the same logo since 1901. Over 100 years. That's timeless. No one is saying we need a new logo. We need a new team. We don't need a new logo. God's truth cuts across time and space, and it remains relevant, insightful, and life-giving, no matter the culture it finds itself in, no matter the community that it is in, no matter the year. I have found that to be true. I sit down with my Bible, I open it up, I read it, and I'm amazed. I'm amazed that a book that is 2,000 or more, and more, years old, 4,000 in some circumstances, even older, can tell me truth that fits for my day. for my life. It gives me something to hold on to. Psalms that are written by a warrior poet king can have influence in my life. Proverbs that came from a king of wisdom can speak directly to what I'm dealing with in that day. Teachings from a man from over 2,000 years ago play right into how you live your life out in your workplace. What do we hold on to? We hold on to this. This is what God has given us. I don't know what you think of all this. Some of you I know well, and I think I know what you think. I know some people think this church is a good thing for kids to be involved in. You know, religion gives us a nice moral compass. There's a nice community feel about what we do. These are nice thoughts, but you're not holding on to anything that's going to get you through. It's like chasing after smoke, chasing after steam, flying a plane through a cloud thinking you're going to be able to grab it. It's not there. In reality, when chaos surrounds us, when the enemy's at the gate, we cling to a man who died and came back to life 2,000 years ago. We hold to a book that is almost just as old, to teachings that some think are archaic and some think are old-fashioned. That's what we believe. That's what we hold on to. That's what's going to get us to what's next. Where do you go for answers? What are you trying to hold on to? The band is going to come up and we're going to sing as we prepare to close. But we have choices about what you're going to hold on to. You can hold on to yourself. Some of you are incredibly successful, and you're successful in large part to the work ethic that you have, the way in which you're wired. And you've seen success after success in your life that you, maybe like Nebuchadnezzar, maybe like Belshazzar, think that you've done. And so you just say, you know what, when times get tough, that's when I show up. But one day you won't be able to just show up. Something's going to come at some point that you're going to realize I can't handle. Sometimes, you know, we look for answers by what other people say. You know, what's being said in culture, in the community? What they say is right, it's the mob mentality, we'll go that way. The community decides this, okay, I'm part of the community. But that changes. Changes all the time. I spoke with a man just this morning whose family grew up in Nazi Germany when the community was saying something. His family, by God's grace, didn't go along with it. But many did, because they decided to just do what other people said. That's not going to be anything to hold on to. What we hold on to is what God says and who God is, because these things never change. These things lead to purpose, they lead to hope, and they lead to life. And so what we need to do is remind ourselves of the greatness of God, because when we begin to understand better and we begin to embrace how great God is, we'll realize that this is something not just that we can hold on to, but something that we want to hold on to. Something that we trust that when we hold on to it, it will grip us back. He will become what we hold on to. Why? Because he's the greatest. When my daughter was on that thing, she came off that sheep. That was one of the proudest moments of my life. As her dad. Okay, I have proud moments with all my children. That was maybe one of hers. And I thought, she's great. When I read about God, I realize he's great. He's wonderful. He's merciful. He's kind. He's holy. He's just. He made a way for me to have a right relationship with him when I couldn't. He didn't abandon me. He sent Jesus. He's creative. He's wonderful. And when I'm reminded of these things, I cling to him out of desperation, but also out of love and also out of appreciation. So I want to invite you to stand, because we're going to close by reminding ourselves of God's greatness.
Give me eyes to see more of you. greater still. Grace to see beyond this moment here, to believe that there is nothing left to fear, and that you alone are high above it all. You, my God, are greater still.
Father, no words can convey, no song can say of your greatness. In the midst of suffering, in the midst of uncertainty, and in the midst of failure,